From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. This week on The Lines Between Us, the path to a paycheck. Certain neighborhoods in Baltimore are dealing with consistently high unemployment. We ask, what work is out there and what training programs exist to connect the unemployed to the jobs? We hear from a Baltimore mom who's been out of work for more than a year and learn about a new website that helps people navigate their job search. Then, in the weeks before his death, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke out on behalf of laborers in Memphis. A new play at Center Stage imagines a conversation Dr. King had with a hotel maid the night before he was assassinated. Tom Hall discusses King's legacy with the play's director, Kwame Kwe Arma. Plus a Baltimore story from Gilbert Sandler. Now, today's news.
You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast. I'm producer Lawrence Lanahan. Go to our website for more podcasts, audio archives, and lots more. You can also make a pledge to support rich local programming like Maryland Morning. That's WYPR.org. Click on the Maryland Morning link. Now back to the show.
This is The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning, WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Since early 2009, unemployment in Baltimore City has hovered around 10%. But in certain neighborhoods, the number is much higher, such as the Oliver neighborhood in East Baltimore, where one out of every four people is out of work. We wanted to find out, why is there such persistent unemployment in particular areas of the city? What employers in the region are in need of workers, and what programs exist to connect the unemployed to those paychecks? One of those people in need of a job is Rokia McCullough. She's 24 years old, has been looking for work for more than a year. She's been volunteering as an administrative assistant at the Oliver Community Association in the meantime, and she's with me here in the studio. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Jason Perkins-Cohen. He's executive director of the Jobs Opportunities Task Force and one of the forces behind a website called Train Baltimore. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. is Jennifer Vey. She's a fellow with the Brookings Institution and the author of a report published last spring called Building from Strength, Creating Opportunity in Greater Baltimore's Next Economy. Welcome back, Jennifer.
Thanks so much for having me.
Rokia, tell us about your job search. What kind of jobs have you been looking for?
Well, in the past, I've looked for teaching jobs and childcare because that was like my preference, but then I moved on trying to get better income for my family, so I moved on to nursing since that was in such high demand, and it was a bust with that. And now I'm trying to explore my options on really what is best and more possible to actually acquire income. So,
what is your educational background?
Well, I have gone to different trainings, and I'm in college now.
What are you studying?
Well, sociology and psychology. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to get on the board again, but as I've done multiple trainings as far as nursing assistants, geriatric assistant, teaching, I've done my schooling for that. For your 90 hours, your 90 certification hours for dealing with children at a certain age, that's required to work in the childcare field.
So you've got those mm-hmm. certifications, but you're not finding takers when you look for those jobs.
Well, like I said, with my teaching, I just recently started my look for that again, because it seemed like that's my best bet. But then the thing is that with that, you barely make a minimum wage. So it's like the highest you make as a child care teacher is maybe $8 an hour. And I don't know about you, but trying to survive off $8 an hour is really difficult because I have three children.
And so that's not where you're focusing your job search now?
Well, that's where I am. Yeah, I am focusing that on now because I'm trying to go to school and whatnot and try to make do with what I have.
Jason, say someone like Rokia just graduated from high school and was trying to figure out how to get a job. What resources are available through the state and the city to help people figure that out?
Well, there are some resources. I mean, it's Rokia, as she said, it's really tough. It's a tough job market. There are opportunities, things like one-stop centers where you can go that the state runs, or in this case, the city runs. You can go in; it's open to the public. There are individuals there that they have job openings, job listings. They know about available training, but it's still a challenge. I mean, they only can do what jobs are available, and so if the jobs aren't open, they at times they really do struggle.
Jennifer, in your report last spring, Building from Strength, you outlined several areas of potential job growth in middle wage jobs. Describe some of those fields.
Sure. Well, what our report really focused on was looking at how an economy could grow, because when you're talking about what the barriers are for people to be able to access well-paying jobs, it really starts with the kind of jobs an economy has and the kind of jobs that they're growing. So we really wanted to look at what the jobs were that Brookings refers to as next economy jobs, jobs that are more export-oriented, that are more innovative, that are greener, and then that ultimately promote better opportunity. So in the Baltimore region, I looked at jobs that sort of met that criteria, or sectors of the economy that met that criteria, and looked specifically at areas like manufacturing, bioscience, information technology, transportation, and logistics. One of the things that I learned as doing this report is that in Baltimore, the region, the vast majority of low-income residents either, one, they currently work or they held a job at some point during the past 5 years. So while unemployment is really a key problem, the problem with folks being low income isn't just being chronically unemployed, but it's actually working in jobs that don't happen to pay very good wages. And in fact, 3/4 of the area's low income workers are employed in only a handful of industries, things like healthcare and social and education services and accommodation and food services and retail, that have really large numbers of low paying jobs. And I think this was something that Rokia was pointing to when she was saying, you know, a lot of the jobs out there just, you know, only pay $8 an hour and you can't live off of that. And that's exactly the case when you look at the fact that low-income workers are employed in jobs that don't pay well, and that's partly a function of just how the economy's been growing.
And Jason, do any of those areas open up opportunities? I mean, you say it's really tight.
Yeah, I think Jennifer has plenty of data in the Brookings report that shows that those are growing industry sectors. And offer a lot of opportunity. I still think it presents challenges for people, again, to try and break into those opportunities, because often they need a credential and they need experience. And people are starting from whatever place they're starting in, so they have a hard time, again, breaking into that. It's a real challenge. I do want to mention one thing about the point that Jennifer was making. It's not, and maybe this is obvious, but a lot of times we focus on sort of the unemployed, and that's a huge group to be concerned about. But it's not just that people, you know, have worked recently. It's often that people are working and still poor. So there's, and I don't have the data in front of me, and I can't remember, Jennifer, if it's actually that those numbers and percentages are in your report. But there's a huge percentage of our population that works every day, works really hard, does exactly what we think as a society someone should do, and can't get by, can't make, you know, and not because of anything that they're doing wrong. They can't pay their bills. They can't pay their rent, or at least they're severe risk. They can't pay their rent. They can't pay their utilities. They can't buy enough food to put food on their table for their families, and. Again, that's another just gigantic issue, and I don't want to keep coming back and, you know, beating the dead horse about training, but it's another reason why people need to find career ladders to the middle-skill jobs that Jennifer's report touches on and that Rakia is talking about looking for herself, because otherwise people are spinning their wheels, and it's more than a hard way to go.
Rokia, you're nodding very vehemently as Jason talks about experience.
Yes, because it's just that even with the, like, background experience that you might have, because especially, like, with computers and nursing, again, like, those fields, they say, are, like, the future. Those are the growing things. So now you have to worry about getting the education for that. And from experience, I know that even with the education, it's not, because it's an employer's market. It's not an employee's market. They pick and choose what I've expressed. They pick and choose what they want. And the thing is that because there's so many people who really look alike, in trying to stand out, because with a computer job by itself, you have at least 1,000 people with the exact same looking resume. So how do you pick through that? How do you even stand out? So how do you get a job with that?
Well, I think one of the things that really helps, and Rakia certainly has gone about this the right way and tried, is training. Again, I mean, there are some really good training programs in and around the city, some better than others, that provide you with something that you can put in your hand. It's a credential, something on your resume, that can show an employer that you have something that is of more interest to them. If the training program is good, often they will help you get a job in the field. which, again, you sort of have a natural advocate to help you get your foot in the door. I mean, that's what training programs should have. They should have connections to the employers in those industries. And if people, we created a website called trainbaltimore.org.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. First of all, why? Why did you create, is another website what we need?
Well, I think.
Apparently you thought so.
I think so, yeah. So we actually hear a lot of stories like Rakia's about people who are frustrated, you know, that they can't get their foot in the door. They've tried certain training programs. Sometimes they're successful and sometimes they're not. But what is surprising to people is you can't go, you know, we can go online and find out information about movies and hotels and restaurants and things like that. But up until now, you really couldn't find detailed information about all of the occupational skills training programs around Baltimore. So we collected all that information in one place. It has 150 occupational skills training programs. Searchable database. It's free. There's no advertising. There's nothing like that. And you can go on and find out if you know of the field that you're interested in, you can go search by that industry. So if you want healthcare or you want manufacturing, you can go and find out all the training programs that are located around the city, because people weren't able to find those training programs before, because we heard it all the time when we were doing focus groups. But the other thing they'll find, which is really important, which again Rakia speaks to, is, you know, the quality of those training programs. So people need to know before they invest their time, in some cases their money, in training programs, what the expectations are when they get out. So they should know what a typical entry-level wage will be when they complete the training to make sure it's a good fit for what they want and need. They'll know how long it is. They'll know the requirements to get in, so they're also not wasting their time. And they should have a sense of how long it will be before they get a job.
But I was struck by something else. I was struck by something on the Train Baltimore website, that part of it is directed toward finding the work you'd really like to do. I think a lot of us think, okay, it's desperate times, train for any job you can get. And I'm wondering whether you see a connection between finding something people can get excited about and their eventual success in following through on the training, in following through on finding a job.
So, you know, our tagline is build your skills, find your path. And it's a really delicate balance, because on the one hand, you want to encourage people to go train for where the good jobs are, right? That makes a lot of intuitive sense. On the other hand, you know, people's heart has to be in it. We get this all the time in some training programs where people will go into a training program because, again, their neighbor or their friend got a good job. Let's say it's construction training, but they don't want to work outside. At the end of the day, we all have to, you know, we have to get something from our job beyond the paycheck, right? It's hard to do it forever and not really like it. And so if you don't want to work outside, you don't want to get your hands dirty, your construction's not for you, even if there is a good job there. So people might go through the training and get that job because they got to pay their bills. But ultimately, you know, all of us, whether you're wealthy or not wealthy, you want a job that you enjoy. And everyone has that dream. And so this allows you to make those decisions and weigh those options.
This is WYPR Maryland Morning, The Lines Between Us. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Jason Perkins-Cohen, Executive Director of the Jobs Opportunities Task Force. I'm also joined by Jennifer Vey, a fellow with the Brookings Institution, and by Rokia McCullough, who's volunteering at the Oliver Community Association in Baltimore while she continues her job search. Jennifer, why are there certain neighborhoods where unemployment is so consistently high? I mean, are there some particular trends?
I think there's a mix of reasons, you know, certainly. I think what you wind up having is certain areas where, you know, you have a high concentration of low-income residents already, and then it sort of leads to a situation where people don't always have the networks and the knowledge that you might have if you were living in a different community, for example. And, you know, if you think about how many people know about job prospects, job opportunities, just, you know, career options, they might learn it from family or from community. But for example, and, you know, about a fifth of children living in Baltimore City live in families in which neither parent has a high school diploma. And about 11% grow up in neighborhoods with poverty rates of about 40% or even higher. So what happens is, you know, lower income job seekers then tend to have fewer and smaller networks of relatives and friends and acquaintances who work in well-paying fields or have direct information about training programs and job opportunities. And then they probably also have fewer ties to people who may be able to personally vouch for their character, their abilities, or who really have a vested interest in helping them to secure a decent job. And I think this is what then you know, if you're sort of in the system, and as I think Rokia was saying, then you're sort of left to these other avenues that are open for you. If you don't have some of those networks and personal connections, then you have to rely on you know, the other organizations or institutions to help you make those connections, and they may not always be doing it so well.
And Jason, for people who don't have a strong network behind them, can a job training program fill that?
Well, it can certainly help, and it's actually really why, information out on the web is so important, because if, again, people are using all of us use our networks for all kinds of reasons, whether it's job-related or otherwise, and if you don't have a strong network, what we have found is, you know, people end up going to a training program because their neighbor or their friend found success there, and that's fine, but it's not ultimately what they want to do. So it's really important that a job training program, for example, first of all, the information is out there so that people can expand their networks, or at least their information networks. And then once they access a good job training program, that's really, it's not only just about the hard skills that someone's learning, if they're learning to be a nurse, all the skills you need to know to be a nurse or to be a chef or whatever it is their person is training for. It's also about those networks. I mean, the training programs should have close industry connections to employers so that when the person graduates from the program, that training program can make a call and say, hey, I have a really good candidate. You have used our service before and found good candidates. Here's another one for you. And they should have a whole series of those connections, not just really relying on the individual to go out with a piece of paper in their hand and find their own connections.
Jennifer, you wrote last year a lot about the need for coordination in training programs and also, I think, in making jobs, in informing people about jobs that might exist. I mean, do you see any progress?
I think people are talking. I mean, I think, you know, given the times that we're in, certainly, I mean, this is something not just in Baltimore, but everybody is obviously hyper-focused on how do you address some of these challenges, and they're not easy, certainly. But, I know around the Baltimore region, for example, you know, that people are really making, you know, efforts to talk about, all right, where are we going to see some of the potential growth happening, or where are some of those industries where there are, you know, good wage jobs, but where there are needs? A lot of work right now, for example, is being done around the issue of manufacturing, and there are folks both in the workforce community and in the education community and private sector, you know, actual firms that are really starting to engage in conversations with the state as well about, for example, in this particular sector, manufacturing, of what are really the needs? I mean, what are some of the specific skills that employers are looking for and they can't find? I mean, manufacturing, for example, is a sector where they have a lot of, you know, older workers that will be retiring soon, and they don't necessarily have that backfill of these, you know, of skilled people. And by skilled, I don't mean people that have a four-year degree, but people who have some, you know, some training and also have, you know, a certain amount of knowledge and very specific skills in particular areas. And their active conversations about, well, if there are these gaps, how do you fill them, and how do you develop the curriculum and the training programs and education to help make this match between where the needs are and people looking for jobs.
You know, the good news here is it's not all bad news. I mean, the good news is, I think, is that for one thing, we have reports like Jennifer's that point us to where we need to be aiming, where the good jobs are going to be. We're getting more information about where the training programs are, so we can map it. As policymakers, we can map what is available currently. Are they aiming towards the good jobs or not? Where are they located, and where the residents are? So we have to connect these dots. And we know a lot about what our city's barriers are. So again, it's hard to get away from the education issue when you have nearly half your population that doesn't have a high school diploma or GED. So if we know what the problems are, and we know where the solutions are in terms of the good jobs, we just have to sort of change the way we're doing things so that we're aiming in the right direction.
Rokia, what keeps you going in your job search? You've been at this a year now.
Well, education has always been a big thing for me. So even if I was working, I'd still be going to school. That's my main thing. Like I said, just thing really keeps me on is my babies. My babies, my little nappy-headed kids. I love them all, but it's just that I want them to see that mommy even though mommy is not working and she can't give everything to you, they don't know that. They know that mommy gets up, she gets, takes her shower, she gets dressed, she gets out the house, and she know that mommy dresses nice. She goes somewhere throughout the day, and she comes home, and she makes sure there's food on the table, and we have a roof over our head. That's all that matters. That is all that matters. As long as they know that mommy does not sit about and do nothing, then they won't sit about and do nothing.
I really appreciate you all talking to us. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rokia McCullough is 24 years old and a mom. She's been volunteering with the Oliver Community Association while she looks for a job. Jason Perkins-Cohen is executive director of the Jobs Opportunities Task Force and one of the forces behind a website called Train Baltimore. And Jennifer Vey is a fellow with the Brookings Institution and author of a report that came out last spring called Building from Strength, Creating Opportunity in Greater Baltimore's Next Economy. We've got more of this interview on our website, WYPR.org, including Rokia's questions to Jason about just what she can learn from the Train Baltimore site. We've also got links to maps of how unemployment shows up in the Baltimore region. Click on the Maryland Morning link. We also want to know, what are your plans for the inauguration? It's on January 21st, just over a week away. Will you be heading to Washington? Are you going to be hosting a party? Or are you boycotting the event entirely? Let us know at 410-881-3162. Again, that's 410-881-3162. Or email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. And a programming note, during the culture calendar on Wednesday, we mentioned that Congressman John Lewis would be speaking at the Pratt Library on Sunday. That's been canceled. The congressman's wife, Lillian Lewis, passed away last week. The talk may be rescheduled for later this year. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, when The Lines Between Us continues, we learn how Martin Luther King Jr. became a voice for labor. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Lawrence Lanahan. You're tuned to the Maryland Morning Podcast. Thanks for downloading us. Visit us on the web to leave us comments or hear previous segments. That's WYPR.org. Click on the Maryland Morning link. Now back to the podcast.
You're doing many things here in this struggle. You are demanding that this city will respect the dignity of labor. So often we overlook the worth and the significance of those who are not in professional jobs, of those who are not in the so-called big jobs. But let me say to you tonight, that whenever you are engaged in work that serves humanity and is for the building of humanity, it has dignity and it has worth.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. addressing striking sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee, just 2 weeks before he was murdered on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel. On 88.1, welcome back to The Lines Between Us, our year-long examination of inequality in the Baltimore region. I'm Tom Hall. Before the break, we talked about labor and workforce issues. In the last spring of his life, Dr. King spoke forcefully about workers' rights and the dignity of work. He took a pause from the Poor People's Campaign in New York to travel to Memphis to support the sanitation workers. Baltimore's Center Stage is presenting a play that imagines a conversation between Dr. King and a maid at the Lorraine Motel during this period. the night before his assassination. It's called The Mountaintop. Kwame Kwe Arma, the artistic director of Center Stage, is directing the play, and he joins me in the studio. Good morning.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm great, man. It's great to see you.
As always.
OBE, the Order of the British Empire. I feel like I should be dressed like Mr. Barnes on Downton Abbey.
And, at least bowing.
Yeah, bowing. I'm bowing a lot. So if I go off mic, ladies and gentlemen, you'll understand I'm just bowing to Kwame here. So in this last period, these last few weeks of Dr. King's life, he had turned his attention to the labor movement as a civil rights issue.
Yes.
Katori Hall, in her script for The Mountaintop, which I haven't gotten a chance to see, I'm going to see it Tuesday night, really looking forward to it. Does she take this up? I mean, is Dr. King's current obsession a big part of this script?
It is, actually. It's what's really interesting is, Tom, is that in growing up, I wasn't necessarily a King man, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. I was more a kind of Malcolm X man, quote unquote. And what Katori's done with this play is look at the King, not the King that comes along with a kind of Black History Month at McDonald's. But as looked at King, the man who is moving into the economic struggle even more than racials, that he's looking at capitalism, that he's looking at structural inequalities, and that he's trying to find, there's a wonderful speech in it when he starts speaking about how can we send our boys off to Vietnam? How can we bomb Vietnam and not look after those who are poor in America? How can we, he rants often in the play about structural inequality. And so one of the wonderful things about it is I think one of the things Katori is trying to hint at in the play is it is that off branch that really made him dangerous. It is that trajectory mm-hmm. that made him a dangerous person, and that
yeah, he was a little safer to the majority culture when he was just talking about civil rights.
Correct.
But all of a sudden, when civil rights are equated with economic justice,
absolutely.
And labor issues,
absolutely,
yeah.
And even reparations. I mean, he mm-hmm. speaks about the blank check, etc., that America has signed to its African American community, and so. Very much he became more of a danger at that point. And Katori explores that in this character. I mean, let me say, in the play, it's not your standardized Martin Luther King kind of cardboard cutout. Mm-hmm. She goes in and she shows many sides of him. And it's a fantastical play. It's imagined. It's not fact. But I think you've absolutely put your finger on it when you say that right at the core is his growth into how to fight structural and capital inequality.
And we learn a lot about him, or at least as Ms. Hall imagines him, his personal yeah. life. As you say, this is not the public King.
Yes.
This is a private conversation he's having with the maid,
yes.
whom she names Kame.
Correct.
Right, who is the name of her mother.
That's right.
Which is
that's
interesting.
Right.
Where did she glean her history here?
Well, Katori, and I'm very pleased to say I know her very well. And in fact, I met her on one of my very first visits to America. And she says that much of the stories came from, or at least the catalyst for it, came from her mother, who was a maid and would speak about hearing Martin Luther King speak. And that she grew up with stories of King and his last night. And I think I often describe this play as coming from God's mouth to Katori's ear. It is a spiritual play as well as a reconstruction of a man. And I do mean reconstruction of a man. As you say, we see a King who is human.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that so much better than the myth.
Sure.
We're human.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if there's a central message in the play, Katori is trying to say if this human being can have achieved this much, then we all can.
Mm-hmm. There, for example, I guess she discusses the fact that he struggled with depression
yeah.
late in his life.
Yeah. And who wouldn't?
Sure. Exactly.
I mean,
death threats every day.
Correct.
Right.
Tapes right. being sent to your wife that you're struggling even within the movement. I mean, there's a speech in it where he says, everybody shoots me down at nearly every suggestion I make. He's talking about Jesse. He's talking about Andrew. He's talking about, where everybody challenges me. This is, of course, one would suffer from depression. You are leading a movement and it's lovely now with 2020 hindsight to kind of look and say, yes, here's the hero of civil rights. But he was pushing a huge cart up a hill every day. And that must be not only physically exhausting, it must have been mentally exhausting in a way that many of us will never understand.
Absolutely. Kwame Kwe Arma is the artistic director of Baltimore's Center Stage. He's directing The Mountaintop at Center Stage on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. You mentioned you were kind of a Malcolm X man instead of a King man.
Yeah. You're a false binary, by the way.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I later realized.
Fair enough. But yes. But and you're not an African American. You're an African Caribbean. You know,
yes.
British, right?
Yeah, for what
so better. What? I mean, King has such a singular standing in the history of the United States in a way that no white figure does. Mm. I mean, you know, if you say who's the most important African American of the 20th century, almost everyone's going to say King.
Absolutely.
You know, yet there's no white equivalent to that. Yes. But what was King's stature and standing for you growing up in Britain at just after the time that he was, you know, very much involved in the public eye?
I mean, very much for the black community in Britain, which is slightly disparate in that some had come from the Caribbean and some had come from Africa. He was a hero. And a hero, because we, in an odd way, what America does with race, in my humble opinion, is often it hits it head on, and so you had something to fight against. In Britain, racism kind of reared its head and rears its head in a slightly more obtuse way. So it becomes slightly more difficult to come straight at it. And so Martin Luther King was articulating all of the things that we had been going through, except for voting rights. We'd had voting rights in the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
But even though many of the islands were still colonial, was still owned by Britain. But he was articulating many of the needs and the cries of the black community and inspiring. For instance, in an area outside of London called Bristol, Martin Luther King's bus boycotts led to the Bristol bus boycotts. So one could call upon his moral authority because we would receive the news. And without a shadow of a doubt, he was a total hero. For my generation, and I was born slightly after King was assassinated, well, actually a year before, so I would have been like one or something. He became a hero and then an anti-hero. An anti-hero because we would repeatedly just see the images of dogs biting and water cannon being fired, and that somehow affected our notion. And I shouldn't just say our notion, but certainly some of us in my generation.
Well, your whole notion of America.
Correct.
Right? I mean, your whole notion of what this society
is. And how to deal with it.
And it was a mess.
Do you know how to deal with it? Yeah. Seeing that, it had a profound effect on one's sense of one's own masculinity. Like, you know, should I let these people be punching me in the face and letting their dogs out on me and doing nothing?
Yeah, non-violence.
Right.
No,
of course we understand the great moral fortitude that it took. But as a young man, you kind of look at that and you go, nothing in my body says that I should be doing this. Mm. As I said, later on, and particularly a rather wonderful book by Michael Eric Dyson, the public intellectual, when he started speaking about Martin and Martin's move towards articulating things about reparations, articulating things about structural inequality, as we've spoken about, that I began to realize, this man is not only the great man that I was told, he really is, really was great and extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. And took risks like crazy because, as you say, those were the things. I mean, his opposition to the Vietnam War, there are people in the movement saying, forget that issue.
That's not our business. That's not our business. Right. Yes.
But he related the whole thing. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And this play, it seems like her insights then are done from a perspective of an artist, not the perspective of an historian, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's beautifully articulated. It is. It is an artistic vision and painting of King's last night. And one could say King's last dream. You know, I discovered that actually only when we were in rehearsal the other day, that there's a moment in the play that I say, I think the dream begins. And when seen through that prism, you know, anything can happen. But what she doesn't do is just go off and kind of do a fantastical kind of bastardization of who King is.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's
not there to buck up the public
impression
anyway. Yeah,
correct.
Right.
But she attacks it from a sense of spirit. And that's also really important for me, Tom.
The Mountaintop by Katori Hall is directed by my guest Kwame Kwe Arma. It's at Baltimore's Center Stage until February 24th. It's in previews until opening night next Wednesday. We've got information on our website. Come to WIPR.org and click on the Maryland Morning link, and we'll take you where you need to go. And we need to go now. Kwame Kwe Arma, thank you so much for being with us, and break a leg with the show.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks so much for listening. Monday morning, I'll take a tour of the new Everyman Theater with their artistic director, Vincent Lancisi. We hope you can join us Monday morning on Maryland Morning. Until then, I'm Tom Hall. We appreciate your being with us. We leave you this morning with words from Dr. King in a speech that has come to be known as the Mountaintop Speech, which he gave the night before his death in 1968.
Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.